From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. He's played a failed motivational speaker, a Hollywood star with a sex addiction, and a conjoined twin. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Greg Kinnear about his roles in Little Miss Sunshine, Autofocus, Stuck on You, and his new film Fast Food Nation, based on Eric Schlosser's nonfiction bestseller. Also, no fast food here. We get some tips on how to cook a juicy turkey and make a thick, delicious gravy from culinary expert Shirley Corrier. Her book, Cookwise, explains the science of cooking. And linguist Jeff Nunberg on the convenience and inconvenience of labels like liberal and conservative. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest Greg Kinnear didn't get into acting until he was 31, after he'd hosted a late-night TV talk show and a program on the E! Cable channel called Talk Soup. But he seemed to have a knack for the craft. He soon delivered an Oscar-nominated performance as Jack Nicholson's gay neighbor in the film As Good As It Gets, and he's never looked back. A review in the Times of London said that while Kinnear often played the straight man in films, that Kinnear, quote, through his unconventional depiction of the ordinary, was matching his flashier co-stars shot for shot, line for line. Kinnear's films include Autofocus, Nurse Betty, Stuck on You, and more recently Little Miss Sunshine and Fast Food Nation, a dramatization of Eric Schlosser's book about the fast food and meatpacking industries. He plays a new marketing executive for a fast food franchise called Mickey's. In this clip, he's at the company's lab smelling samples of some new artificial flavors.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, you like that? That's the barbecue big one.
Wow, tastes like it's right off the grill.
You don't think it needs like liquid smoke or any other kind of flavorings?
No, I think it's perfect. Let's test that.
Okay, try this one.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, these Caribbean seasonings are kind of tricky.
Well, we're calling them Calypso chicken tenders. I think people are going to have an expectation for maybe a touch of lime.
Oh, well, lime's easy. I just held back on the terpenoline on this to keep the flavoring subtle. But I can always go back and add more.
Yeah. Why don't you try that?
We'll keep working on it.
Greg Kinnear and many in the cast of Fast Food Nation visited meatpacking plants and shot some scenes there. I asked him what he saw that surprised him.
Well, the first thing I was surprised at was the sort of covert nature that the production was being operated under. We had gone under a fictitious production name. Instead of going by Fast Food Nation, we went as Coyote. And that was because I believe Eric doesn't have a lot of fans in the meatpacking industry. And they control and obviously have total control over a lot of the warehouses and the meat in the slaughterhouses where we wanted to get access to. So that caused us to head south of the border, and they managed to secure a plant about 300 miles south of El Paso and an area of Chihuahua. And we went down there and used those facilities.
So you're in a Mexican meatpacking plant. Did the folks running the plant know what the movie was about or what you were up to?
Yeah, they did. And they were, they were comfortable with it, comfortable enough that once we got down there, there was no secrecy about what it was we were doing. I don't know about all the, discussions that went on in order to get us in there, but they were, really cooperative. And the truth is there are, and it's explained neatly in the movie and it's explained in the book, there's two different worlds in the meat world. I mean, there is the packing facilities where the beef is frozen in huge, huge machines that I couldn't believe the size of these things. And so quickly, I mean, it's 40 below zero. This patty starts out as a little piece of ground beef and comes out just as a brick of, like a rock. And these facilities where, the meat is ground and then frozen and then prepared to be shipped off are pretty clean and pretty impressive operations. And, Chris Christopherson's character, who's an old cattle rancher in the movie, talks about, talks to Don as he's sort of naively kind of going through this whole world. And he says, "Did they show you the kill floor?"
Right.
That's my Chris, by the way. That was not dubbed in.
Not bad.
I naively say, "Well, no, they didn't." And he says, "They didn't show you anything." And the truth is, where those cattle are kept and the kill floors themselves are bloody, tough conditions, obviously.
This character that you play, Don Anderson, is this executive for this huge fast food conglomerate, and he is supposed to – he's new to the company and is looking into potential contamination in the meat. And he is, in some respects, a very morally conflicted guy. I mean, he's got a regular job and a wife who's busy shopping online for sheets. And in some respects, I found it a little unsatisfying that we kind of don't get quite to the bottom of either his own moral dilemma or exactly what's going on. And I guess in some respects, that's maybe the point here, right? Is that this is there are issues here without villains?
I think so. I mean, I know what you mean. I'm in the movie, and there's some sense of that's you know, tangible that you feel when you watch it. But you know, the truth is, we want our characters to stand up and say they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. And wouldn't that be nice if Don was going to be that guy? And unfortunately, the guy that they've drawn here has car payments and two children to keep in school and has real obligations. And I think that speaks to maybe a lot of people who have questions about things that they might want to do something about or maybe not feel right about, but they also have, real, they live in the real world and they have real obligations to take care of day in and day out. And so they're willing to kind of ignore that mm-hmm. voice, maybe, and I think Don is one of those guys, and we're not used to seeing that kind of person in our movie characters. Right. I mean, you know, we're looking for Chuck Norris here, and it just isn't going to happen. And to me, that was what was just interesting about this particular guy. Hadn't been asked to kind of undergo that sort of challenge before, and I kind of thought it was a revelation in a way.
If you're just joining me, my guest is actor Greg Kinnear. His new film is Fast Food Nation. Well, Greg Kinnear, you're also starring in Little Miss Sunshine, which is this terrific story of this crazy, dysfunctional family in a VW bus taking their daughter to a beauty pageant. We got the grandfather kicked out of the nursing home for snorting heroin, the teenage boy who's quit talking, your brother-in-law, the Proust scholar who's recovering from a suicide attempt. You're this is one of those films. You play, of course, a wannabe self-help guru who's sort of the patriarch of the family. This is one of those. It struck me that this is one of these stories that, if I looked at a script of this, I might think it's just ridiculous and might never work. What did you think when you saw the story?
I thought it was kind of tragic. I mean, certainly there's the funny stuff in it, and I got the comedic elements, but there was a part of certainly the character that I was asked to play, Richard Hoover, as you say, is a failing motivational speaker. That's a good place to start from for an actor, by the way. Just the struggles that he's going through and trying to kind of hold his family together while he faces ruin. I mean, all that just seemed really interesting to me, and the fact that we got such a good cast was just an added bonus.
Well, let's hear a clip from the film. This is one where you're on your way to, it's Los Angeles, I guess, for the beauty pageant. You're driving.
Yes.
And your wife, Toni Collette, is there, and you're describing your hopes for becoming this very successful motivational author and speaker, and you're talking about the guy who's going to promote your stuff. And you get into a little thing with your brother-in-law, who's in the back seat. He's played by Steve Carell, who's this brooding Proust scholar. Let's listen.
So finally, I'm just sitting there, and I decide, you know, this is Stan Grossman. What the hell? And I start pitching him the 9 steps, and about, I don't know, 2 minutes in, he stops me. He says, I can sell this.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, and this is the guy who knows how to do it, you know? You start with a book, and then you do a media tour, corporate events, DVD, VHS series. I mean, there's a whole fascinating science into how you roll these things out.
Wow.
Yeah, so he's in Scottsdale right now, you know, building the buzz and kind of getting the whole hype thing going. He's doing what the pros call a ticking clock auction.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, and I can detect that note of sarcasm there, Frank.
What sarcasm? I didn't hear.
But I want you to know something. I feel sorry for you.
You do? Good.
Yeah, I do. Because sarcasm is the refuge of losers.
It is? Really?
Yep. Sarcasm is losers trying to bring winners down to their level, and that's step 4 in the program.
Wow, Richard, you've really opened my eyes to what a loser I am. How much do I owe you for those pearls of wisdom?
Oh, that one's on the house, buddy.
It is?
Yeah, it's on the house. That's on the house.
And that's my guest, Greg Kinnear, the motivational speaker there, arguing with his brother-in-law, played by Steve Carell in the new film Little Miss Sunshine. You have all these wacky characters and this terrific cast with Alan Arkin and Tony Collette and Paul Dano and Steve Carell and you. And then kind of the fulcrum in the middle of it is this 10-year-old actor, Abigail Breslin, who plays the 7-year-old Olive. And I know that this was not a big-budget film, and you had a 30-day shooting schedule, I believe.
30 days with one day reshoot. So we really made it up all in a day.
What's it like working with a child actor? Did you have to develop a particularly close relationship with her?
I had a good relationship with Abigail immediately. I think anybody who would meet her would instantly warm to her. I mean, that comes across on the screen, just that incredible humanity of hers. She is such a sweet girl, and a girl, by the way. You know, the amazing thing is that her acting is so wonderful. She is such a presence on camera that you kind of lose sight. I mean, there were six of us. We'd be sitting around talking and every once in a while, you'd glance over and Abigail would be, you know, munching down a Twinkie and playing with a yo-yo. And you'd be like, oh, my God, that's right. She's 9. And you would have to remind yourself because she just doesn't have the presence of a child.
And the other interesting thing in a modest budget film like that is you did have some action sequences here, because one of the funny gags is that the bus is semi-crippled and you kind of have to push start it every time. What was it like shooting those sequences?
Well, you know, of course, I'm driving this old rickety 1969 bus, and we're not ever pushing it because they're heavy and they're hard to push. Note to those who think you can push your VW buses, there takes more than three or four people. So I would actually have my foot on the accelerator and just try and get it up to enough speeds to sell the joke that they were pushing it and that it wasn't being run by a motor. And, of course, the great fear was that I would accelerate too fast and that the people who had to then all jump on the bus wouldn't be able to jump on the bus. We didn't have a big stunt coordinator budget on this movie, as you can imagine. So somebody came up to me and whispered shortly before the first time we tried this little trick, you know, we think Abigail can go about 3 miles an hour. So take it easy on the speed. So it was... more stress in this movie came from not ever acting. I never had a moment where I was worried about that. It was all about driving, because we didn't have the budget, obviously, to shut down freeways. And if you were driving around L.A. on a freeway last summer, there's a hell of a good chance you're in our movie, because we were everywhere and I was always behind the wheel.
My guest is actor Greg Kinnear. His new film is Fast Food Nation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, we're speaking with actor Greg Kinnear. His latest film is Fast Food Nation. You know, I know that before you got into film, you spent time as a TV talk show host. And, of course, you hosted this this very successful show in which you introduced cuts of wild things that were happening on other talk shows like Jerry Springer, Talk Soup, I guess it was called. But I was curious about the time that you spent as a talk show host and whether you think that experience contributed things to your acting ability and career, characters that you drew on, a certain presence that you got?
Well, I it's hard to say. That was my experience, so I don't have anything to compare it with. But out of college, I worked at a kind of a very low-budget cable channel out here. It was E before it was even called E. It was called Movie Time, and basically went in front of a camera every day for about 4 hours and tried to fill time. And, it's hard to say what experiences, inform you know, my work now, I assume everything does to some degree. You know, whether it's some sort of comfort level early on with a camera, it's an odd thing. You know, obviously acting isn't, you know, got a craft all to its own, but when you stick a large, you know, 400-pound camera in front of you while you're trying to do that, it can be distracting, and maybe somewhere along the way I got that issue out of the way.
What made you want to take the leap into acting?
Well, you know, I had been kind of just as you say, I was doing a talk soup and a show at talk show over at NBC, thank God, I don't know, Sidney Pollack was really in a pickle. He was casting Sabrina and was looking for Harrison Ford's younger brother, and asked me to come in and audition. And you know, I had studied drama in college, and I always had interest in it, but it just kind of followed a different path, and was fine doing what I was doing. But really, it was that opportunity that let me kind of switch gears. And I didn't switch gears immediately. For a while, I was doing a talk show in the day and being an actor at night, or vice versa. And it was I was kind of cheating on both careers. So I ended up obviously just pursuing film.
You know, one of the other films that's an interesting role for you was the Farrelly Brothers film Stuck on You, where you played conjoined twins with Matt Damon, which is it's really actually a sweet movie. But I wondered if you had any reservations about taking that role when it could be seen as being in such terrible taste.
Well, I thought that Peter Farrelly and Bobby Farrelly, who I know, who actually have done a lot on behalf of the, you know, handicapped people, and have done a lot to try to put characters in their movies who may have physical challenges and let them be part of the joke. In other words, not treat them with kid gloves and not say, you know, it's almost like a reverse discrimination where, okay, well, they're handicapped, so we're not allowed to have any, they're not allowed to be part of the joke. There's not allowed to be any humor when dealing with somebody like that. And I think that is an ongoing issue that you can kind of find pieces of in all of their films. So, you know, I felt like they would treat it properly. And moreover, when I read the script, the fact that they're, you know, that Bob and Walt are conjoined is really secondary for them. The only people who struggle with that or have an issue with that are the people who surround them. It has nothing to do, you know, with their own, you know, issues of their, you know, shortcomings, because they don't see it as that. They don't see any challenges. They don't see any difficulties. And I think that's, you know, I think that's true of a lot of, you know, people who might have, you know, any kind of handicap, that the issue is in the people around them and less about them.
The other thing that's interesting about that film from the Greg Kinnear point of view is that's, in this film, you get to belt out a show tune with a big band at the end of the song. Summertime must
that's
have been
right.
fun. Yeah.
Ah, it was great, actually. I'd never recorded anything before, and I was half, you know, Pete sent me the Billy, who was that?
The Billy Stewart that did this.
Yeah,
the
Billy
version.
Stewart, right. He sent me the original Billy Stewart, and he said, you know, you need to start listening to this right as soon as I signed on to the movie. And I was thinking, what the hell am I listening to this for? And then he sprung it on me that I was going to go down to somebody's garage and do a recording of it. But the real highlight was, of course, Meryl Streep agreeing to come on and do the dance number with me at the end of the movie. It was a very surreal couple of days, and she was a great sport for playing along.
So talk show to Oscar nomination, now to singing star, maybe, huh?
yeah, my whole CD, OVL, will be coming out shortly.
A summertime, and the living is easy. Fish are jumping, don't you know, my darling? I sit right now in the cotton. Like a, your life is rich and rich.
That's Greg Kinnear. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Pretty baby, oh, 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 follow from your eyes. Come on!
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Complete Sherlock Holmes, in stores and online at bn.com. From the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Autofocus. We talk with Greg Kinnear about playing actor Bob Crane, whose career was undone by his sex addiction. Also, what's the right temperature to cook a turkey? And how long should that bird stay in the oven? We have some tips from culinary expert Shirley Corrier, and Jeff Nunberg considers the labels liberal and conservative. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest is actor Greg Kinnear. He was nominated for an Oscar for his role in As Good As It Gets. His other films include Nurse Betty, Stuck on You, and most recently, Little Miss Sunshine and Fast Food Nation, a dramatization of Eric Schlosser's book about the fast food and meatpacking industries. Well, I do want to talk about one of your films, which is memorable to me, that's Autofocus, directed by Paul Schrader, which is this remarkable story of Bob Crane, who starred in Hogan's Heroes in the late 60s. And his life essentially unravels with a sexual addiction and this friendship with this character, John Carpenter, no relation to the film director, but who was his partner in scoring women, and Carpenter equipped him with videotaping equipment to capture his sexual exploits. You were the lead. You played Bob Crane. Tell us what appealed to you about this role and how you got into the character.
Well, I was very intrigued with the story. I mean, Bob Crane's sexual addiction was something that I was very unfamiliar with and unaware, as I think a lot of people were. I knew him as Hogan, and a kind of fun-loving presence on television, but the fact that he had that kind of sort of a dual personality, and those kind of underlying demons was obviously just interesting off the bat. You know, Paul Schrader is a very, very interesting, you know, American filmmaker, and his direction of that was, it seemed like a great match, you know, because there were parts of that script written by Michael Gerbosi that were very funny, and I got those, you know, parts were quite clear to me. And then there was a very dark, subversive side to this relationship between Bob and Carpenter, that started kind of fun and playful, but like all things, started to move into the area of getting a little sordid.
One of the many interesting and weird things about the Bob Crane story is his family's kind of connection to he is now dead. He was killed in 1978, but his son, right, Bob Crane Jr., was a consultant on the film. And in fact, it has a cameo appearance, I believe, interviewing somebody.
He does. Me.
You. That's right. That would be you. I'm just curious. Did you talk? I'm sure you must have talked to him about his dad. And how did he perceive his dad's sexual addiction and the way it undid him?
Well, he didn't, you know, he became aware of it in his latter years, and certainly when he was, you know, in high school and college, or, you know, right out of high school, he started to get a real sense of what a problem this was, and, you know, faced, you know, other kids who were aware of it. It was pretty much under wraps around Hollywood, but you know, slowly started to come out a little bit. But, you know, Robert Crane Jr., he was a real helpful guy, just in terms of giving me some sense of who exactly his dad was. He had a lot of, you know, old, you know, tapes, not porn tapes, but tapes of his father performing, and a few interviews and things that I thought were very revealing from his early radio days, by the way. He was a big disc jockey out here in Los Angeles, kind of the Rick Dees of his time at one point. And he, you know, had that, again, that sort of ability to keep everything snappy and happy. And the fact that, you know, these two people existed and were pretty amazing. And we needed that kind of insight along the way, and Robert helped us with that.
Was there anything in those early tapes that you recall that you kind of fastened on and said, wow, this is it, I get him?
Well, you know, Paul Schrader had a recording that he found between that Bob and Carpy had made about sexual liaisons with women. I'm trying to look for the NPR safe way to put this. And they did a recording, a musical recording of a song that they had produced together about their sexual conquests. It's a song with like background singers, and they thought they were going to maybe, you know, make an album of it or something. And I thought it was so strange that I think, you know, more than anything, it spoke to kind of their relationship in their world and in what they were doing at that time. It had just all become so normal that, you know, they weren't doing anything wrong. I mean, Bob says repeatedly in autofocus, you know, sex is normal. I'm a normal guy. And of course, that's true. Sex is normal. And that's the, you know, curious thing about sexual addiction, because it's normal up until the point where you're doing it starts to impede on your, you know, your relationship with your, you know, your family and your children and your job. And that, of course, is, you know, all came tumbling down for him towards the end. And there were some indications that he was, you know, trying to put his life back together at the end, and had made sort of a split with Carpenter, which you know, is possibly some of the suggestion that Carpenter, you know, was responsible for the murder of Bob, but who knows?
Well, you know, I wanted to play a clip from the film which captures a moment in Bob Crane's life when he's really come unraveled, and his career, which was really soaring when he did Hogan's Hero, had descended to dinner theater and was now at the point where the best gig he could get was going on a show called Celebrity Cooks. And this is you as Bob Crane going on this cooking show and behaving badly. And I'll note, since it's not clear from the audio. At some point in the scene, we'll hear him notice a woman in the first row of the studio audience who has a very low-cut blouse. So let's hear this cut from autofocus.
Welcome to Celebrity Cooks. My name is Bruno Gerussi. Today, we'll be cooking with Colonel Hogan himself, Mr. Bob Crane.
Thank you, Bruno. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful to see you. Now, what has Hogan been up to?
Pretty much the same old thing. I'm still trying to pull the wool over Clink's eyes. And trying to get into Hilda's pants. Actually, I did get into her pants. I married her. But now she's divorcing me, so.
Oh.
That's not worked out. But I will be next month in Long Beach performing a show called Beginner's Luck.
Wonderful. So, Bob, what recipe have you brought us today?
It is a pasta dish with chicken and fettuccine, they tell me. That's what they told me to say anyway. I don't even
know. Sounds delicious.
You got a balloon smuggler here in the audience today. You got a license to carry those things? Here's a little tip on how to remove the wrinkles from your face. Just take off your bra.
Oh,
calm down. Boo. Calm down. They'll cut all this stuff out. They edit it and they take all this stuff out.
That's my guest, Greg Kinnear, playing Bob Crane in the film Autofocus. Do you know if that scene is based on a real incident?
It is. There was a cooking show up in Canada. It was a live broadcast, and there is, or at least Paul Schrader was not able to locate the tape of it, but it was a pretty talked about incident that people were aware of where Bob had gone on to the cooking show and just... you know, there was an indication in his presence there that he was starting to maybe lose his way a little bit, and of course that was the beginning of a lot of things in his life.
You are working a lot. I mean, you've got three movies out this year, I think, and I know that you've just had your second child. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I mean, I know from having kids myself what a wonderful time it is to have toddlers at home. Do you think about slowing down, or how you're going to manage a busy acting career and a family?
Well, I have slowed down. You know, it's a funny thing about movies is at times when you're not busy at all, people will come up to you and say, "You are so busy," not really, figuring on the math, which is
you were busy a year ago.
A year ago, you couldn't stop me a year ago. This year, I worked for a few months with Robert Benton up in Portland on a movie, but aside from that, I have a 5-month-old daughter and a 3-year-old, and we've had plenty of time this year. I think they're all the girls and my wife, they're ready to get daddy out of the house again, because the truth is I really haven't done that much this year. And that's kind of the great luxury of films is obviously when you're away and you're working, you are all of that. But when you're not, you really get the benefit of getting to spend some time with your family. And that's been the case this year.
Well, Greg Kinnear, we're happy you were able to find some time for us. Thanks a lot.
And thank you for having me.
Greg Kinnear starred recently in Little Miss Sunshine. His latest film is Fast Food Nation. Coming up, what you need to know about cooking a Thanksgiving turkey and how it works. This is Fresh Air. In case it sneaked up on you, Thanksgiving is just a week away. Some of us are panicking. So we thought we could turn to Shirley Courier for some cooking advice. Not only can she give you recipes for a great Thanksgiving dinner, she can explain the science and chemistry behind the techniques. Courier is the cook many restaurant and test kitchen chefs call to explain why a recipe is failing and how to fix it. She's a former biochemist and a contributing editor of Fine Cooking magazine. Her book, Cookwise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking, won the 1998 James Beard Award for Food Reference and Techniques. She also has a new DVD called Kitchen Secrets Revealed, which is available through her website, ShirleyCourier.com. Terry Gross spoke with her after Cookwise was published. She asked Courier to explain some of the principles that will help us make a better turkey.
Well, my absolutely favorite thing to do with turkeys and with large roasting hens, and I've even done it with shrimp, is to soak them in brine. Now, this is what I do, say, with the large hen. I would use like a full cup of salt. Now, with the turkey, the smaller turkeys, I'd go with a cup and a half of salt and put them in a large container that I could cover it with ice water and keep it in the refrigerator overnight. Then before you roast the turkey, you want to rinse it very well, get all the surface salt off. And it is astonishing how much juicier turkeys are prepared in this way. And they've weighed birds, you know, before and after brining, and they gain weight significantly. And you can certainly see it in the incredible juiciness.
Now, what principles determine how long to cook a turkey and what temperature to roast it at?
Well, now, I think anybody you ask is going to have a different answer on this. And I'd certainly advise people, if they have a system that has worked, stick with it. Some things to remember. The leg and thigh meat has to be cooked to a higher temperature than the breast, and this is a real problem. Those legs and thighs actually taste metallic and slimy if they're not cooked over 165 degrees Fahrenheit. And then the breast, on the other hand, which is the broad expanse that gets the most heat usually, that starts drying out anywhere from 155 up. It's getting drier and losing more moisture. So what I try to do is arrange it in the pan so that I can actually move the whole pan and the bird over to one wall so that it's near the hot wall of the oven to get that leg and thigh cooked well. And then I divide the time, and then I push it over to the other wall so the other leg and thigh get some extra heat on the cooking time. I think everybody's oven varies dramatically, and it's just impossible correct times, I believe, and temperatures. We can talk a little bit about temperatures. I like to start at a very high temperature and then turn the oven down for slower cooking. I want to get the outside hot. Get things really going, and then turn it down so that it cooks more slowly to stay juicy and tender inside. So I would say I would actually start a bird maybe 450, 475. And if the bird's not too big, I start it breast down then do these to both sides, and then flip it over.
You are an advocate of a good thermometer. How do you use the thermometer when you're roasting a turkey?
Well, you want to try to be careful not to touch bone. So I like to insert insert it once in the thigh and try to get into the fleshy area and go down so that, you know, at least an inch or so of the thermometer shaft is into the bird. And now this is with one of the little instant reads. Some people, and now on the breast, I insert it there also. So I like to check both places, check the temperature of the leg and thigh, and check the temperature on the breast. Now, the big fat-based thermometers go into the bird, and I would say they would have to go into the breast portion of the bird and can remain in during the whole cooking time. The important thing to remember is that that temperature is going to increase after you take the bird out of the oven. So be sure to get the bird out before it reaches your maximum temperature.
But wait, well, why is the temperature going to increase after you take it out of the hot oven?
Oh, because, see, the outside of that bird was super hot, and that heat is still being conducted from layer to layer to layer inward. And a big turkey could increase easily 10 degrees after it comes out of the oven. So you want to be sure to get it out 10 degrees before you really want it.
What temperature do you look for?
Now, we're the FDA absolutely insists on 180 degrees. So this would mean get it out at 170. I think the breast is way too dry at that, and I'm willing to take my risk personally to go, a little lower on that. I hate to cook a turkey breast over 160.
And you've never been sued by your guests?
They've all survived.
They've all survived.
Goodness, Terry.
Okay. My guest is Shirley Carrier, and she is a cook, a food writer, and an expert on the science of cooking. Now, for people who want to make, say, an interesting potato dish.
Yes.
For Thanksgiving, what would you recommend?
Well, my grandmother's old-fashioned grated sweet potato pudding is sensational. It's totally different from any of the modern sweet potato dishes. You grate the sweet potatoes raw, and actually what you do, you can do it in a processor just with the chopping knife and chop it with quick on-offs until the pieces are small like rice. And you stir these raw chopped sweet potatoes with a cup of brown sugar and a cup of half and half or cream. My grandmother used, her whole milk on the farm. And 2 teaspoons of dry ginger, and I think a little salt, and a tablespoon of cornmeal, and 1 egg. And stir this together and bake. It's a deep brown and a very unusual texture. But it's a truly old, old dish. I know some of my students make it every year for Christmas and Thanksgiving, and one took it a big plate over to a nearby nursing home. And she said one of the little ladies who was in her 90s, when she started eating it, that tears rolled down her cheeks. She said, I haven't had this dish since I was a little girl. Another great family tip I'd love to pass on.
Please, yeah.
My mother made the best gravy imaginable.
Yes, I should ask you about gravy. Go ahead.
Well, I watched her and I thought I knew exactly how she did it. But what I missed all these years was that she would take out 1 or 2 cups of the raw dressing mix, before when she mixed it up and put it in the pan. She would save 1 or 2 cups and add that to the gravy to thicken it. And it was marvelous. You don't realize it's there, but the gravy has then all the wonderful flavors and the, sage and herbs and onions and celery that you had in the dressing, are in there. And it's just a wonderful touch.
So when you say that your mother added dressing to the gravy, this she would add some of the stuffing to the gravy?
Yes, the raw stuffing before it's baked.
The raw stuffing. Okay.
The raw stuffing, which, is composed of the breadcrumbs and herbs and onion and celery. So she would put that raw stuffing into the drippings and the gravy, and it would thicken so much nicer than just cornstarch or flour alone.
Well, I want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you, and I certainly wish everyone good luck with their turkey and cakes and pies.
Shirley Corrier's book is Cookwise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking. Coming up, Jeff Nunberg on the meaning of political labels. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The election results didn't just reshuffle the Congress. They also got people debating the meaning of labels used to map out the political spectrum. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about what's in a label.
If you ever find yourself desperate for a conversation starter, you might drop the observation that the word label is related to lap, which was originally a piece of cloth that hangs down at the bottom of a garment. A little part of that meaning survives in the way we talk about political labels, with the implication that they're merely tags tacked on to things for convenience. We don't ordinarily say that duck is a label for a kind of waterfowl. Duck is just a name. Whereas calling a word a label implies that it distorts or oversimplifies the category it's attached to. You hear people say, "I don't believe in labels," but nobody ever says, "I don't believe in names." Even so, we can't help imputing a reality to labels. Putting the Porsche name on a pair of sunglasses can invest them with the same panache we associate with the cars, even if we know perfectly well that the two have nothing in common. That's the principle that leads everybody to claim a political label when it's riding high in the saddle. At the heyday of liberalism in the 1950s and 1960s, everybody was happy to wear the label, from Stevenson to Eisenhower to the Dixiecrats. And nobody was too interested in debating its essence. As the critic Lionel Trilling wrote, "Liberalism was merely a tendency, not a body of doctrine." That began to change in the 70s and 80s, as a combination of liberal missteps and conservative attacks drove the liberal label from center stage. Politicians who would once have proudly owned up to the label began to flee from it. Old tribal differences no longer seemed important. People stopped distinguishing between progressive liberals, moderate liberals, practical liberals, northern liberals, traditional liberals, and New Deal liberals. Now the label was reduced to a small band of diehards clinging to the edges of the political continent. Since then, of course, it's the conservative label that has swollen to contain multitudes, particularly as the ideological poles were redefined to add social issues that nobody had much cared about when the liberal-conservative opposition first emerged in the New Deal era. A recent Harris poll showed that Americans are much more likely to identify people as being liberal or conservative according to their views on abortion or gay rights than on whether they want to cut taxes. That's why the media invariably describe anti-abortion or pro-gun Democrats like James Webb, John Tester, or Bob Casey as conservatives, even if they actually campaigned on the kind of economic populism that defined liberalism 50 years ago. In fact, the label social liberal is regarded as almost a redundancy these days, as if it went without saying. 15 or 20 years ago, the phrase was as frequent as social conservative in the media. Now it's outnumbered by social conservative by almost 20-1. The mark of a successful label is that we feel the need to make distinctions and qualifications among the many groups that are laying claim to it. Nowadays, it's the conservative label that attracts a clutch of modifiers: social, economic, small government, fiscal, libertarian, traditional, neo, and paleo. But the big tent conservative label began to fray as the administration's poll ratings declined precipitously, and since the elections, it appears to be coming apart at the seams. True, everybody on the right wants to claim that the voters didn't repudiate true conservatism. The Republicans would still be in power if they'd only been faithful to core conservative principles. But each constituency has a different idea of what those core principles are and how they were betrayed. For James Dobson of Focus on the Family, the Republicans' downfall was their failure to do more to preserve moral values. For Dick Armey, it was their refusal to hold the line on spending. And for William F. Buckley, it was a failed Iraq adventure that signaled the absence of an effective conservative ideology, as he put it. Whenever you hear somebody talking about true conservatism or genuine liberalism, you can be sure the argument has more to do with labels than ideas. There's a fear on the right that the voters' dissatisfaction with Republicans may translate into disenchantment with a conservative label itself, just as the liberal label was tarnished by its association with Vietnam and the civil rights backlash. The immediate reaction is for each of the conservative constituencies to claim the right to sole use of the label, and discredit all the pretenders who've been wearing it improperly. In the next election, it's a safe bet that people who call themselves conservatives will be doing a lot more explaining and qualifying than they did the last time around. True, the conservative label is still a very long ways from disintegrating the way the liberal label did after Vietnam. The right doesn't really have to worry seriously until Republicans start saying things like, "I don't believe in labels," always a sign that a label's becoming more of an inconvenience than a convenience. The beauty of a label is that it smooths over the corrugations of the world to create an impression of common purpose. But that's also why it can become an embarrassment when it comes to apportioning blame. At that point, people are just as happy to drop it in somebody else's lap.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start December 4th at capella.edu. From Casey Family Programs, a national foundation working to improve the lives of the 800,000 children who experience foster care every year at casey.org. And from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at wkkf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Real Mafia. Selwyn Rabb is author of Five Families, The Rise, Decline, and Resurgence of America's Most Powerful Mafia Empires. It's a history of the mob, from its roots in Sicily through the downfall of John Gotti to its resurgence after September 11th. It's now out in paperback. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.